It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kant. Data from the Early Childhood Advisory Council show childcare continues to be a major concern for families who struggle with cost, availability, and quality of care, with less than 44% of parents reporting satisfaction with their current arrangements. Join in with your child care questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Erin Arango Escalante is an administrator for the Early Child Care and Education Division of the State Department of Children and Family. She previously worked as the executive director of a child care agency and was an early childhood special education consultant at the State Department of Public Instruction. Erin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
The State Department of Children and Families is in the early stages of this Parent Caregiver Equity Advisory Cabinet. What is it and what problems does the cabinet aim to address?
We are absolutely in the beginning stages of our Parent and Caregiver Equity Advisory Cabinet. Our cabinet is made up of 8 parents from communities that we've typically not worked really closely with. In Wisconsin, those communities are Beloit, Adams County, and the Le Coudray community. As you can see, it's an urban, a rural, and a tribal community to begin with. We were very intentional about those communities. And so we do have members from those communities, plus Milwaukee and Dane County as well. Essentially, we realize that we do not always know the impacts, the unintended consequences of the policies, programs, and decisions that we are making. And our goal is that we are including parents from the get-go in that decision-making process to really understand their needs and how it relates to childcare and to other programs and services that touch their lives in the Birth to Five space.
How can those lived experiences help better inform state policy on early education and childcare?
There's so much that we are learning from our parents and our caregivers. Our parents and caregivers on this cabinet come from very diverse perspectives and experiences. And we are learning how to better connect the dots, the systems, and the programs, and what barriers they are facing. There's things that I have learned in just the few months that I have met with them that I didn't know. And I think a lot of people just didn't know. And so making sure that we are hearing, we are listening, and that they are informing through each step of the process. We are in developing a strategic plan that is a Birth to Five strategic plan, and they will be a tremendous partner along the development of that strategic plan as well. But we're seeing things from their community perspective, from their personal perspectives, and we look forward to engaging in community conversations with each of these cabinet members as well.
And participants are going to be receiving stipends and training and communication support. Why are those elements part of the cabinet?
It's critical. We meet with the cabinet members quarterly, and in between, we have coaching conversations, one-to-one coaching conversations with every cabinet member. We also provide, as you mentioned, stipends and other. We address other barriers that are needed for full participation. So whether it's technology, whatever it may be, we make sure to provide it. We want them to be able to fully participate and to have the support that is necessary. There's a lot of kind of behind the scenes work that we are doing. Again, these are folks that may or may not have had this opportunity to work with policymakers and others. And it's oftentimes a learning curve. There can be a different way of working. We want to make sure that everyone starts on an even playing field where we can really dig deep into some difficult conversations.
We're talking about a new Parent Caregiver Advisory Council through the State Department of Children and Families. Erin Arango-Escalante leads the department's Early Care and Education Division. Erin, a report from the Early Childhood Advisory Council shows that nearly 40% of people living in Wisconsin experience a child care desert. Can you explain what a child care desert is, and how did the state get to this point?
Yeah, it's a great question. A child care desert is essentially different zip codes where there just isn't enough child care for the number of children who are there. This has been decades in the making. This is not something that's new. We have seen tremendous decline in family child care, particularly in our urban areas. In addition, so we've seen that over, like I said, over a decade, it has happened. And, you know, we've also seen increases in some places. I'm going to be just really honest about that. So it's shifting, it's moving. I think what's really important about this is that we are putting programs in place right now, such as Partner Up, which is essentially businesses, employers have the opportunity to purchase slots for their employees to be able to really offset the cost of childcare. So they're purchasing slots, they're putting a match in, the state is also putting a match in, and they're essentially paying the true cost of care to regulated childcare providers in their area. Whether it's a family childcare provider, a group provider, they just need to be a regulated provider. And what's happening is that we are diversifying our revenue. So not only is a private tuition coming in and state dollars coming in, we have employers coming to the table. So that's one huge effort that is happening. We are also seeing through our Dream Up program, various communities doing some great strategic planning around how to increase access to high quality care in their communities. So there's a lot that's happening. And then another great initiative that we see that's coming down very quickly is supporting childcare providers in becoming licensed, so that there are startup costs, there are costs and that are associated with starting a childcare in those rural, primarily northern and western regions. Lots of support in those areas that we are really helping to address our childcare deserts across the state.
It sounds like problems in childcare differ depending on where you live, whether you're urban or rural. But even if urban areas have enough childcare, are there accessibility issues that families face as well?
Yeah, and I argue that I'm not even sure our urban areas are completely equipped for families and families' needs. Particularly our non-standard hours is quite problematic. So wherever you are, I think there are significant issues that we are looking to address. As I mentioned, there's a number of initiatives that we're looking at. Another one is our Child Care Counts program, where we are providing a monthly payment. We're going to have 27 months of payments that go directly to child care providers that focus on increasing access to high quality care, as well as supporting our workforce. So those dollars go directly to those caring for children. That's happening across the state. All regulated childcare providers are eligible for this particular program. But we're also looking at those that are providing, adding an incentive for those that are providing those non-traditional or non-standard hours. So we're incentivizing even in urban and other areas that may not be considered childcare deserts. That's where it gets tricky for families, is meeting their needs. So it's a problem everywhere. It's something that we're hearing from our Parent and Caregiver Equity Advisory Cabinet. We're hearing from providers and communities across the state.
Erin Arango-Escalante is administrator for the Early Care and Education Division of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue our discussion on childcare challenges for families across Wisconsin and answer your questions at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Erin Arango Escalante is administrator for the Early Care and Education Division of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. She has decades of experience working in early education and childcare and is with us for about 10 more minutes. On Tuesday, Governor Tony Evers announced a plan to expand the Child and Dependent Care Credit that helps families with the cost of caregiving and childcare. Erin, the credit could be as much as $1,200. Are tax credits an effective way to offset childcare costs?
Yeah, I believe Governor Evers is looking to provide almost $30 million in relief. And this would be to an estimated 107,000 Wisconsinites. So yes, and this would be beginning in the tax year 2022. So essentially would increase the non-refundable credit match on the Child and Dependent Care Credit. And this was announced initially in the 2021-2023 biennial budget. So this would go from the 50th percent of the federal credit to the 100%. And so I do think this is a piece of the puzzle in terms of supporting childcare.
I have to tell you, I'm 53. My kids are grown and gone. I remember struggling with childcare costs when my kids were little, you know, 25 years ago. I don't even know. How much are Wisconsin families typically paying for childcare now? What is the cost range?
Great question. It is more than college tuition. It is roughly $12,000 annually, depending on the age of the child.
Wow. That number seems like wow. Okay, so I'm just recovering here, Erin. I have to wonder what people are telling you about this. Was there anything surprising in the conversations that you've had, especially around the cost?
Yeah, I do want to be just really clear. We have a broken business model in childcare. The true cost of care, the tuition that we pay, that parents pay for the true cost of care does not cover the tuition that they pay does not cover the true cost of care, that it really costs to provide high quality care to children. And I want to be just really honest, it's a broken business model right now. Essentially, 80% of a budget goes directly to staff salaries and benefits if they have it. And right now, staff on average are significantly underpaid. Anywhere between, depending if you're family or group center, $11 and $13, and less than that if you're in a family center, if you look at that hourly wage. I argue they are doing one of the most important jobs in our state, providing high quality care to our youngest and our future Wisconsinites. And they are not being paid well. The business model is broken, and it has nothing to do with people, businesses, particularly childcare businesses, making money off this. They don't. They run razor thin margins and oftentimes are taking a loss. And so one of the purposes of a lot of these different initiatives is to diversify our revenue in childcare. That's really, really key. It cannot come from parents in private paid tuition or our child care development block grant dollars. It needs to come from other funding sources so that we can increase wages and in compensation for our workforce. That is critical if we are going to address our child care desert issue, as well as continue to provide high quality care for our youngest ones in Wisconsin.
The initiatives like the Child Care Counts initiatives, and I want to mention that applications for the second round of funding are due September 2nd. The Department of Children and Families offers these temporary payments to child care providers that are meant to stabilize the business. And we've talked about some of these incentives. How often do programs like this prevent child care centers from closing? So I guess, in other words, how effective are they in the real world?
Everywhere that I go, I have been told this has been a lifeline. And those are the words that people use. Child Care Counts has been a lifeline to providers so that they didn't have to close. I would I would guess that we would see tremendous closure rates if childcare counts did not exist. And in the future, if there isn't additional funding, we will see providers closing right and left. Whether they're a family provider or a group provider, they're going to close just because there is not enough money in the system. So again, the words that I hear time and time again is it was our lifeline. We would have had to close if childcare counts did not exist.
We're talking about early education and childcare with Erin Arango Escalante. She leads the Early Care and Education Division of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Erin, how can families know if they're receiving quality early childcare services?
A great question. And I think it's from a couple of different perspectives. If you go on our Child Care Finder website at the Department of Children and Families, you can do some research into the various providers that exist in your area. In addition, our child care resource and referral agencies that are across the state can also help you. However, I do think that a lot, and this is what I've heard from our Parent and Caregiver Equity Advisory Cabinet, is that it's how you feel as a parent in your values and what you're looking for in a quality program. Every parent's idea on quality differs. And so when you go and tour and you visit different programs, it's important to think about those values and ask key questions when you're touring or you're talking to either the director or the teacher or anyone who's at the particular program. Make sure that your values align with the kind of care that you are looking for. That's a really key important component in your search for quality care.
What should families do if they have concerns about the care they're getting? I mean, if they've got a child in a program and they start to think there's something not right here, what should they do?
Yeah, as a former teacher and director, I think it's really important to start with the actual program and share your concerns with the teacher, with those who are at the program. If the concerns continue, absolutely reach out to the licensing specialist at the Department of Children and Families. There's a regional licensing office that can be reached out to and contacted directly. But I want to just stress the importance of really having these open and honest conversations with the program. Oftentimes they don't know or they're not aware, and there are changes that they can make in their program that would meet each individual family's needs. But of course, Department of Children and Families is a resource for families as well. And we want to hear what your needs are and how we as a state can better meet the needs of all Wisconsin families.
You are a new Aspen Institute Ascend Fellow. This is a national fellowship that explores mindset and system changes within early education and childcare. How is that fellowship hoping to address childcare problems across the nation?
Yeah, thank you. I actually just came back from Aspen last week. And so I learned a lot about this particular fellowship. And what I will say is the Ascend Fellowship is really connecting the dots across all birth through five systems, childcare being one important dot that needs to be connected, but not the only. And so there are 22 fellows that are working on various sectors in the birth to five space. And we are learning from each other. We are really reflecting and looking within each of our program areas, as well as different states and contexts, and making sure that we are being thoughtful about, again, centering equity, centering the lived experience in families. But in my situation, really looking to connect the dots in all of our birth to five programs so that families have equitable access to all the systems and supports and services for families that they need in these early years. We're trying to make things easier and accessible, including childcare for all families.
We have about 30 seconds left together, and I'm wondering, as this fellowship went for you, did you see that childcare issues are pretty much the same nationwide, or is there something unique to Wisconsin?
Great question. There's problems nationwide. I think the problems look a little different depending on the funding that they have available, depending on you know, different factors, but childcare is an issue nationwide. It is no different in Wisconsin, but we have some work to do in Wisconsin.
Erin, thank you so much. We appreciate you. Erin Arango-Escalante, an administrator for the Early Care and Education Division of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Ahead, we speak with a UW-Madison professor about a new study that says the use of slavery in the 1800s is correlated with rates of gun ownership today. Join in with your questions about this research, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. Each summer, a small group of Milwaukee public school teachers travel thousands of miles to the rainforests of Panama, where they get their hands dirty participating in a tropical ecology research project. The teachers say they bring the experiences back to the classroom with them, helping them inspire their students' curiosity in science. Wisconsin Public Radio contributor Katie Reardon reports.
Isolated in the middle of the Panama Canal, Barro, Colorado Island is cloaked with thick, lush tropical vegetation, home to iconic species like sloths and howler monkeys. With canopy trees overhead and dense tangles of plants below, it can be easy to get turned around.
We must have literally walked right past it.
Among a small crew consulting compasses to point them in the right direction is Blas Antimo Perez. He's a third grade teacher in Milwaukee Public Schools, but today he's also a researcher of sorts, recording the location of individual trees and woody vines as others measure their coordinates.
On the X we have 295, and on the Y we have...
This data collection is part of a program designed to expose Milwaukee educators like Antimo Perez to aspects of the scientific method and topics in environmental science. The ultimate goal is for them to be able to convey the subject to their students outside of textbooks.
It'll help them be like, oh, okay, a scientist can actually go out and roll around in the mud or jump through, you know, vines and trees, and that's also science.
If teachers understand how science is done and are excited about science, then they'll be better teachers.
That's Stefan Schnitzer, a biology professor at Marquette University, who studies why different plant species coexist. He started the so-called Panama Experience for Teachers over a decade ago with funding from the National Science Foundation. For a couple of weeks each summer, the Milwaukee instructors embed with members of his lab. But more than the specifics of his research, Schnitzer says it's important just to immerse the teachers in the rainforest ecosystem. It gives them access to stimulating content that can inspire lessons on concepts such as biodiversity or climate change. This specialty curriculum is then shared online so anyone can use it.
The tropics basically serve as a hook to catch the attention of the students, to get the students to stop and listen and say, wow, you saw that? Tell me about that. Why is that important? And then you can start talking about larger ideas.
This summer's group is finding plenty to get excited about.
Hey, it's a parade of cicadas, you guys. No, really, look. There's one, two, three.
Sarah Osuzik has been teaching in Milwaukee for two decades and helps lead the Panama program. She says traveling to another country pushes many teachers outside their comfort zones. It can also remind them of what it's like to be a student, challenging them to make mistakes and synthesize unfamiliar topics.
And that's actually what teachers ask of our students all the time, right? Like, read all this new information and then tell me what you're going to do with all that new information, right?
Past participants have used their time in Panama to develop units ranging from weather patterns to geological formations. When Antimo Perez returns to the classroom this fall, he plans to incorporate the photos and recordings he's gathered of tropical creatures like toucans and crocodiles into units on animals and plants. Mostly, though, he wants to instill that anyone can do science.
Getting them away from the idea that science is you're in a lab with a lab coat with a syringe and a beaker. which can be very appealing to students sometimes. But I think also having them see that it's just picking up and observing.
And maybe one day, he says, they'll get to observe on a jungle excursion all their own. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Katie Reardon.
It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer Kent. American attitudes about gun ownership are deeply ingrained in our culture and our history. Before the Civil War, firearms were largely considered tools for hunting or for sport. But after the war, that all changed as the belief that guns were necessary for protection grew prominent, not just among those living in the South, but throughout the country. Join in this discussion on the history behind America's firearm philosophy. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Buttrick is an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Madison. He recently published a paper that examined American gun culture and its relationship to white Southerners during Reconstruction. The paper is titled Historical Prevalence of Slavery Predicts Contemporary American Gun Ownership. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Nick, what led you to examine this relationship between contemporary gun culture and backlash to Reconstruction after the Civil War? Why this?
Well, we started with the observation that America has a lot of guns, first off. There's about more than one gun for every man, woman, and child in this country. And that the way that we tend to think about guns seems to differ quite a bit from everywhere else in the world. Americans overwhelmingly tend to say that guns are the sort of thing that keeps them safe, that protects them from danger. And in most of the rest of the world, people are more likely to say that a gun is the sort of thing that's actually dangerous itself, that needs to have certain sorts of protections around it. And so we've been thinking about why, you know, what is it about America that leads to this prevalent belief? You know, what is it in our history or our traditions? And we started doing some research. And when we go back to the Revolutionary era, the founding, we seem to notice that historians tell us that guns were treated very differently than they are today. Mostly as, you know, tools, as things for hunting, for sport, but not necessarily as the sort of thing that an individual person would use to keep themselves safe. And so when we're looking through the course of American history, when we think about what is it that shapes the present, you know, it's really natural for us to think about one of the signal events in American culture, which was slavery and the dissolution of it. And so when we looked into the period after the dissolution of slavery in the Reconstruction era, we start seeing there a lot more rhetoric about the idea that the world is unsafe and that the government is unable or unwilling to protect white Southerners. And out of these two elements, we think, are some of the genesis for modern American protective gun ownership culture.
And why the reaction to Reconstruction? I mean, what was it about that pivoted the ideas that people had about gun ownership specifically?
So the Civil War is a really fascinating period for a lot of reasons, but it's one of the times when modern American firearms technology really starts to take off. It's one of the first wars in which you have mass-produced weapons sort of at massive scale. And so after the war, you have white Southerners coming home with their weapons, which is a fairly new phenomenon. We think there's about, the estimates are, I think about 1 million weapons come back into a society. And it's a society which has been broken, right? The war really wrecked the Southern economy, it wrecked Southern culture. And so you have a huge influx of weapons. You have a very dangerous state. The estimates are that there's about 14 times higher murder rate in the South at that point, as opposed to the North. Mostly white on white or white on black crime. And you have the emancipation of Black Americans. So you have a radical shift in the ways that power relations work. And so what we think happens is the white planter elite, those people who'd been in power before the war, try to figure out how to reclaim power. And this later happens as part of the redemption period in which you see the repression of the Reconstruction administrations. And so you have a massive worldview threat, a huge amount of weapons, and rhetoric that this Northern government that's been imposed is unwilling or unable to keep you safe. And so we think that this is sort of a part of a longstanding project at the point in that moment in time to buttress white supremacy and to reclaim political power from the threat of Black voting blocs.
August from Viroqua called. He couldn't stay with us, but he wanted to make a point. He's a gun owner. He said that he grew up watching Western shows that show good guys with guns and said that it's kind of created a mentality among gun owners that they're the good guy, movie heroes with guns. And guns can be fun and responsible, but at the end of the day, August said it's an object. What do you say about what August shared with us?
Yeah, we think that media representations themselves are very interesting. One thing that we've looked at in our work is whether a connection to the actual frontier seems to matter. And so what we've looked at is whether people who were on the frontier or whether a connection to the frontier socially across time seems to predict gun ownership. And we find actually that it doesn't. And this seems to track a lot with historians who suggest that the experience of living on the frontier wasn't exactly what it was cracked up to be, and that the way that it impacted our culture maybe not be exactly the way that it's portrayed in movies. But I do take the caller's point that the way that guns have been marketed is a major part of contemporary American gun culture. And we don't want to say that the way that people think about guns today is solely because of things that happened 150 or 200 years ago. Contemporary marketing clearly has quite a large part to play.
How are views different now compared to the aftermath of the Civil War? I mean, that sounds like it was a turning point, right, in the way that Americans viewed guns. How did it further evolve to where we are now?
Yeah. In the present, we find a far higher belief that guns are the sort of things that keep somebody safe. We think that in the post-Civil War period, it may have been largely something that was a Southern set of beliefs. At this point, we're pretty sure that it's spread throughout the entire country. We also think that one of the things that's really driven this is the change in weapons themselves. Nowadays, you see far more pistols and revolvers and sort of small guns sold. Whereas, you know, even 50, 60 years ago, the bulk of guns that were sold in this country were long guns, guns that are more suited for hunting, for target shooting, for sport. And so as the actual stocks of guns shifts, the marketing that goes along with selling them, I think, shifts as well.
Nick Butterick is an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Madison. He recently published a paper that examined American gun culture and its relationship to white Southerners following Reconstruction. Join in on how Southern attitudes and philosophies spread to Northern countries and became prevalent even in today's society. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. Americans' attitudes about guns differ significantly from people around the globe, a disparity that may have roots dating back to the Civil War. Nick Butterick is an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Madison. He recently published a paper that examined American gun culture and its relationship to white Southerners following Reconstruction. Join in. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick, other researchers have pointed to the idea that a Southern culture of honor as one possible explanation for the roots of U.S. gun culture. What is this culture of honor as you understand it?
Yeah, so a culture of honor is the sort of thing that develops in a place where it's really hard to do central policing and in which the sorts of goods and services that you have can be stolen from you fairly easily. And the argument goes that in these sorts of places that are often rural, often fairly mountainous, you need to build up a reputation that if somebody tries to mess with you, you'll go get them. Essentially, you have to have a reputation as being strong and tough and somebody who will respond with quite a bit of force if anybody tries to steal your things, because a central government won't do that work for you. And we find in our own work that a culture of honor does seem to explain part of the current day distribution of guns in America, but that the historical patterns of enslavement actually seem to matter quite a bit more. So those two things may actually be related, but they are doing slightly different things, and that both may in fact be true.
We have Mike with us from Camp Douglas on the phone. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I was just going to say, anybody who thinks a gun gives you a lot of comfort hasn't been any place where you might really need one. And then the television is continuous shootouts. It's everything on television, from channel to channel. There's shootouts, gunfire, running around. No wonder people are so goofy. And then you've got Michael, the guy running for senator, and he's got a loaded machine gun in his ad.
You know, Mike, thank you for bringing that up. Nick, what do you think about what Mike said about what you see on TV and, you know, what you see in advertisements? How does that impact ideas and feelings about the guns?
Yeah, I think it certainly plays quite a large part. One of the things that we think is really interesting is, of course, the entire country sees these same sorts of advertisements, sees these same sorts of movies, and yet we still see the evidence of historical patterns of enslavement today. And so one of the things that we think might be happening is you get certain sort of cultural templates that are created and then passed down intergenerationally. And it's only when these templates meet something like a cultural sort of flood of images, such as we see from TV and from movies, that the two come together in order to form a really solid gun culture. And so it's a little bit of this historical transmission of beliefs and a little bit of the contemporary flood of gun, you can call it propaganda, that create what we see in American culture today.
We have Robert on the phone from Wausau. Robert, hello. Robert, are you with us? I think we may have lost Robert. Hopefully we can get him back. But in the meantime, Nick, you say there is a southern route to modern U.S. gun culture, and this philosophy spread to other regions. So how did these attitudes spread to northern states, including Wisconsin?
Yeah, we think one big part of it is that people move. So people in America tended to be quite mobile, and they would go from place to place. And so as people who were born in the South or sort of grew up with these beliefs move around the country, we think they play quite a large part in spreading the beliefs to the places in which they come. And one of the ways we looked at that is through Facebook friendships. And we can find that the places that have more Facebook friends with parts of the South are those places that have a higher prevalence of gun ownership today. So if a Facebook friendship means that you have more friends, you have more family in a place, we think it's evidence that people have been moving and bringing beliefs with them.
I believe we have Robert with us now from Wausau. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to make a statement as an observation that I think that gun ownership over the years and even more recently has become more of an issue, just like the arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union, back 60s, 70s, 80s, from the standpoint of we want to make sure that we have weapons to defend us against those people who are criminals and won't abide by any of the rules. And so every time we end up having a change in presidential leadership, you see an uptick in people purchasing weapons for themselves when Democrats or liberals are going to go into power because of the fear of losing that ability to protect themselves. And so from the South to the North, or from criminals to law-abiding citizens, they do it to protect themselves even if they never need them.
Thank you, Robert. Nick, what do you say to Robert's point?
Yeah, I think that it's a really interesting point. And I think one of the things that we've been investigating in some of our follow-up work is where this belief that you need to have a gun in order to protect yourself from criminal others, you know, sort of how that plays out differently in various parts of the country. So who that criminal other is. And I think it varies quite a bit based on things like who the government in power is. I think, at least historically, if you look back in the 1860s, 1870s, that criminal other was fairly well defined in the South. And it may be defined slightly differently in the North, but for Southern whites in the 1860s and 1870s, that criminal other was often either a Northerner or a Black citizen. And in some work that we're doing right now, we're trying to see how much those stereotypes carry through to what somebody imagines as the sort of bad guy with a gun that they're trying to protect against. But we think it likely will have some of the same imprint, not completely, as it did 150 years ago.
We have got just about a minute and a half left, but I wanted to go to the phone. Jeff is here from Delafield. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. To your guest point, if gun ownership was primarily seen as tools for sporting, hunting, target shooting, whatever, all the way up until, you know, maybe 50 years ago to his point, and then the change occurred where people, you know, were more into the handguns, the what we call today assault weapons. If that change occurred only 50 years ago, I'm not following the connection to the Civil War.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
Nick, what's the answer to Jeff's question? What's the connection?
So, I think that the connection is that the belief that guns are the sort of thing that keeps one safe isn't just a 50 years old sort of phenomenon, that it does, in fact, trace back at least to Reconstruction. One of the things that we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years is a strengthening of that belief, a sort of reinforcement of it. And what we think is going on is that you need to have a belief in place before it can be really strengthened. And so you have the template set back 150, 200 years ago. And then contemporary marketing is sort of playing on those fears, playing on those worries, playing on those beliefs to really strengthen the idea that a gun is the sort of thing that can keep a person safe.
Where should this research in this area go next?
Yeah, we think it's just a first step, of course, as all research is. We're really interested right now in the ways that different sorts of groups in society think about what a gun can do and think about how protection works. Like I mentioned before, we're interested in sort of who are you protecting against? And so we've been focusing a lot on whites and white Southerners, but we're really interested in the Black community as well, sort of what that relationship to weapons looks like. And how people think about it. Of course, it also leads to the point that these cultural beliefs are very old, we think, that they're very well ingrained in society. And so if you're thinking about what something like gun regulation or gun policy should look like, we think it makes a lot of sense to at least consider the fact that some of the beliefs that we have a sort of long historical root.
Nick, thank you so much for being here today. Nick Butrick, an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Madison, who recently published a paper that examined American gun culture and its relationship to white Southerners following Reconstruction. Just ahead, we speak with a linguist from Washington University about the efforts to collect definitions and histories of words to form the Oxford Dictionary of African-American English. I'm Shereen Seward. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.